you to this transmission, and we'd like to begin by giving you our frequencies and wavelengths. We are calling on 9,531.46 meters, on 11,715 kilohertz, 25.61 meters, and on 15,305 kilohertz, 19.60 meters. We begin our offerings today with a newscast. After that, there's the weekly Swiss roundup, and then we'll invite you to take an excursion with us through the canton of Vaud in the French-speaking part of the country in a program called Let's Discover Switzerland. For Italian-speaking Swiss abroad, there'll be another Prisma Svizzero program beginning at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We now turn you over to our news department and wish you all very good listening.
This is Switzerland reporting world news. Reports from France say government officials, employers, and trade union leaders, meeting to break the strike deadlock gripping the country, have agreed on a 36% increase in the minimum wage. However, correspondents say that no formal agreement has been reached. Meanwhile, new violence is reported from a number of provincial capitals. In Bordeaux, where the situation is said to be still serious, 20 people were hurt, 5 of them badly, in clashes with police. Violence and demonstrations are also reported from Lyon and several other cities, but the capital, Paris, is reported calm after weeks of violent demonstrations by students and striking workers. The French Prime Minister, Mr. Pompidou, has suspended the right of assembly and ordered police to break up all street meetings. The renewed outbreak of violence in the provinces follows a televised speech by the French leader, General de Gaulle, who announced a referendum to be held next month. The West German Foreign Minister, Mr. Brandt, says the survival of parliamentary government is now at stake in Western Europe. He told the convention in West Berlin that it would soon become apparent whether the negation of parliamentary democracy in France would lead to a questioning of the existence of parliamentarianism altogether. He said he hoped France would show the strength to find solutions now which would lead the way. Police in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, have dispersed hundreds of student rioters who tried to occupy the opera house and other public buildings. The police, using batons, drove off the students who had marched through the streets, breaking windows and attempting to enter the central railway station. The students later returned to the students' union building, which they occupied earlier. Reports say that several students were injured. The United States Defense Department says a Soviet bomber has crashed into the sea off the west coast of Norway after making a low pass over the American aircraft carrier Essex. The Defense Department said 3 bodies were recovered and passed to a Soviet destroyer which was nearby. The statement said that American forces taking part in anti-submarine exercises in no way threatened or interfered with the bomber, a Tupolev Tu-16, which usually carries a crew of 7. There has been no official Soviet reaction to the news of the crash. Another heart transplant operation has been announced in the United States. The Medical College of Virginia says it has completed its first transplant and that the patient's condition is satisfactory. Neither the patient nor the donor was identified. It is the world's 16th heart transplant. Only 5 patients are still alive. You are listening to World News from Switzerland. An Israeli military spokesman says that 3 Arab guerrillas and 1 Israeli soldier have been killed in a gun battle between Israeli forces and Arab infiltrators near the Jordan River. The spokesman claims that the infiltrators escaped across the river dragging 2 or 3 men believed to have been wounded. An Another brief artillery duel was reported tonight between Israeli and Jordanian forces. In Gaza, Israeli troops fired shots in the air when about 400 Arabs, shouting pro-Nasser slogans, demonstrated against a curfew. The demonstrators, who set up barricades and hurled stones, were dispersed after several hours. Reports say several people were injured and a number of people arrested. Meanwhile, Arab guerrilla organizations claim to have killed or wounded 120 Israeli troops today in a raid on a camp in the Jordan Valley. American investigators are reported to have denied claims that the United States nuclear submarine Swordfish caused high radioactivity after a visit to Sasebo in Japan. The leader of a team of scientists investigating the Japanese claims is quoted as saying that the submarine's reactor was closed down soon after the vessel arrived in Sasebo in early May, and that no water coolant had been discharged in port. Japanese scientists are reported to be skeptical about the American denial. Nigeria and the breakaway eastern region of Biafra today held another session of talks in Kampala, Uganda, aimed at ending their 11-month-old civil war. President Obote of Uganda has nominated his foreign minister, Mr. Odaka, as an observer at the talks, although Biafra had originally demanded that President Obote act as chairman. The British Prime Minister, Mr. Wilson, said today that Britain will not compromise on the issue of majority rule in Rhodesia. Speaking in Scotland, Mr. Wilson blamed failure to reach a settlement of the independence issue on the Rhodesian regime's refusal to provide what he called human guarantees for progress to majority rule. In Zambia, 2,200 workers have gone on strike for higher wages at one of the biggest mines in Africa, the lead and zinc mine at Broken Hill. All mining and production operations have been halted by the strike, which was called after the breakdown of talks with management officials. About 400 students have staged an anti-Vietnam demonstration outside the United States consulate in the English city of Liverpool. Extra police were called in, and the students were dispersed after smashing one of the consulate's windows and damaging a door. South Vietnam's new Prime Minister, Mr. Tran Phan Vuong, today presented his cabinet to President Chu. Correspondents say the list was mainly of independent politicians with no particular allegiance to any faction. They add that the key post of foreign minister will go to Mr. Tran Chan Tan, a former member of the Viet Minh, which fought against the French in Indochina. Now to end world news, here are the main points again. Reports from Paris say that government officials, employers, and trade union leaders have decided on a new wages agreement in an attempt to end the French strikes. Violence is continuing throughout the country, but Paris is reported calm. The United States Defense Department says that a Soviet bomber has crashed after flying close to an American aircraft carrier off the coast of Norway. The world's 16th heart transplant operation has been carried out in the United States. Now, Swiss news. A branch of the Swiss SIBA concern, the Pipes Systems Division of the SIBA Products Company, has just opened a new plant in Texas in the United States. The new research and production center, which cost several million dollars, will manufacture fiberglass reinforced pipes for the natural gas and oil industries in the United States and Canada. 30 years of moral rearmament will be celebrated at Cannes, at the Swiss lakeside resort at Montreux, during the first 3 days of June. commemoration of the movement's foundation by the American religious leader Frank Buckman will not be given up entirely to conferences and discussions. A gay note will be introduced by the presentation of two musical comedies. One of them, entitled It Is Permitted to Lean Out of the Window, will be given at the Théâtre de la Comédie in Geneva. Switzerland has given the World Health Organization 200,000 doses of smallpox vaccine. The Swiss donation was announced at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, together with similar ones from the United States, which gave 20 million doses, the Soviet Union 25 million, and West Germany 2.5 million. Other donors included Belgium, New Zealand, and Czechoslovakia. And that ends this bulletin of news from Switzerland.
We'll pause for a station identification, after which we'll bring you the weekly Swiss roundup. The Swiss Broadcasting Corporation in Bern, Switzerland, is on the air to North America on 31.46, 25.61, and on 19.60 meters.
Swiss Roundup, the news and voices behind the news in Switzerland.
Hello and welcome to this week's program. This is David Simmons in Bern. Sitting in with me this week is
Ron Green.
On today's program, as well as the news, there'll be the 1968 Swiss Science Fair, the changing shape of Swiss cheese, the United Nations Conference on Treaties in Vienna, Dr. Maria Eck Benisch of Zurich, and last of all, Professor Becker of Basel, who's just back from the Middle East.
First, the science fair, which gives Swiss scientists under the age of 21 a chance to win a trip to the United States to take part in the American science fair. Earlier in the week, we talked to the chairman of the competition, Professor Portmann of Basel, about the general implications of the Swiss Science Fair.
How does Swiss scientific education in schools compare with, say, other European countries and education in North America?
You see, there is certainly a difference in details, but I don't think that there is really a difference in level. The scientific education is progressive at present. It was in the background, but now under the general spell of science, it's coming up. And we hope just to do something in this direction for the future of our country.
One last question, Professor Portmann. You said that you hope this sort of thing stimulates interest in young people in their teens to become interested and remain interested in science, because Switzerland, like other countries, needs young scientists. Can I ask you a personal question? Of course, when you were a young boy, when you were a teenager, there was no contest, but were you already interested in zoology, which you've made your career in?
I was interested in zoology from the first moment I could read and write. And there was no difficulty, even if there was no help of any kind. The young people at present have an easier way, that's the only thing. But I may confess that I do not regret the difficulties that we have had.
The chairman of the Swiss Science Fair, Professor Portmann of Basel University. On Wednesday, John Stephen reported on the devastating news that Swiss cheeses are no longer going to be round but square.
Due to the changes in the distribution systems, due to the pre-packaging of cheese, the waste of cutting round cheeses is too big. And as soon as we start to make squared blocks, we have much less waste.
That was the manager of the Swiss cheese union, Otto Scheidecker, talking about the decision of the Swiss cheese industry to replace traditional round cheeses with square blocks. As he pointed out, the change from round to square cheeses will cut down waste. But just as important will be the convenience to supermarkets, for cheese is generally sold in pre-packed squares. The idea of producing Swiss cheese in squared blocks was born about a year ago, and tests were carried out at a school for cheesemakers run by the cheese union. Three factories in the French-speaking area of Western Switzerland then switched part of the production of the local Gruyère cheese to squared blocks, and since then, several other factories have also made the change. For the time being, production of squared and round cheeses at these factories is being checked to see whether there is any difference in quality between the two from day to day. As demand for the squared cheeses increases, production will be stepped up. At the moment, only Gruyère cheese is being tunned out in squares.
John Stephen on changing styles and Swiss cheese production. And for the next few minutes, we leave Switzerland, going east to our next-door neighbour, Austria. Here's Eric Walters with a special report from Vienna.
This is United Nations Radio reporting from Vienna. International life as we know it would be unthinkable without agreements between states. Agreements in written form known as treaties. Today they are treaties concerning just about every sphere of human endeavour. Trade and culture, travel and communications, investments and human rights, science and even outer space. For that matter, the Charter of the United Nations is a treaty. But what are the rules governing treaties? How are treaties concluded? How should they be applied? How can they be amended? When does a treaty come to an end or is invalid to begin with? To provide the answers to these questions, some 300 lawyers and diplomats from over 100 countries have been meeting here in Vienna since the end of March in what is officially known as the United Nations Conference on the Law of Treaties. The purpose of the conference is to work out a convention, a treaty, on treaties. The participants have before them 75 articles of such a convention prepared by the UN's International Law Commission over the past 18 years, an indication of the magnitude and complexity of this undertaking. Inevitably, the discussions here in Vienna are for the most part highly technical, and sometimes the participants spend hours debating a single phrase or even a single word. But this should not mislead us into thinking that the subject matter of the conference is remote from reality and only of academic interest. On the contrary, the reason for the detailed and thorough discussion here in Vienna is precisely the great importance of the law of treaties for the future of international relations. For what is being worked at here is in effect part of a code of behavior by which nations will be expected to abide. Take just one example. One of the proposed articles says that a treaty is void if its conclusion has been procured by the threat or use of force in violation of the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. The importance of this statement immediately becomes apparent when we consider that for centuries the validity of a treaty was not affected by the fact that it had been brought about by the threat or use of force. In other words, nations could impose their will on other nations, and the imposed treaty would be perfectly legal. Now, however, things have changed. With the exception of self-defense against armed attack, the UN Charter prohibits the threat or use of force, and the conference here in Vienna is trying to reformulate the law of treaties accordingly. This work will take time. The present session is scheduled to run until the end of May, and a second series of meetings is planned for next year. But the goal certainly is worth the effort. The goal of a world which will be ruled by law freely accepted by the members of the international community. This is Eric Walters of United Nations Radio reporting from the UN Conference on the Law of Treaties in Vienna.
and from the Austrian capital, Vienna, back to the Swiss capital, Bern, and weekly Swiss Roundup. The director of the Zurich School for Mentally Handicapped Children, Dr. Maria Eck-Benisch, recently returned from the United States, where she received a Joseph Kennedy Foundation Award for her work. Here's a short extract from the Thursday program, where Dr. Eck talked about her work and her school.
We have not enough facilities. We have not yet enough day schools. Of course, we have got 40 until now, but we should have about 10 times so much. We have not enough residential schools either. We have 200 residential institutions for mentally retarded, but we should have the double of it. Nowhere in the world, in any country, there is until now enough done for the mentally retarded. And if someone says in my country we have finished this problem, then he just is lying or is an idealist, because in no country until now it's enough done.
The director of the Zurich School for Mentally Handicapped Children, Dr. Maria Eck-Benisch, bringing home the uncomfortable fact that nowhere near enough is done for the mentally handicapped.
Geneva has gone back to matriarchy. In both the city government and the city parliament, women this week took over key political positions. Mrs. Lise Gérardin of the Radical Party became the first woman mayor of a Swiss city when she was elected president of the government, a post taken in turn by its 7 members. In the city parliament, Miss Jacqueline Vabre, a social democrat, became president after a year as vice president.
In Geneva this week, university authorities and students agreed to set up a joint commission to study problems of modern university education. It's also planned to set up committees made up of professors and students in each faculty. The first such body has already been formed in the Faculty of Arts. Earlier in the week, a students' association drew up a list of suggestions for university reform. One of the main points concerned the present lack of personal contact between professors and students.
Still with universities, the last item on today's roundup comes from Basel. The head of the university there at their astronomy department has recently returned from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where he consulted on the erection of a $30 million telescope. If the Saudi Arabian government goes ahead with their plans, the 200-inch instrument will be equal biggest in the world, along with the telescope on Mount Palomar in California in the United States. In yesterday's Echoes from Switzerland, the man in question, Professor Becker, talked about his visit to the Middle East and pointed out the advantages of erecting a telescope in Saudi Arabia.
We have no very precise figures about this, but of course we can expect that the number of nights is very much larger than it is in European countries, especially in Central Europe. I expect maybe 200 to 250 clear nights each year in comparison with let's say 80 days, 80 nights or 60 nights in our countries here, which is a very large advantage, of course.
And how does this compare with conditions in Mount Palomar in California, where the other 200-inch telescope is?
The telescope itself probably will of a similar type as this Californian telescope. The Californian telescope is a little bit higher in the mountains. The Palomar mountain is, as far as I know, 1600 or 1700 meters. But in central Saudi Arabia, one cannot find mountains higher than 1100 meters. So this is a difference. But the number of clear nights probably will be similar. Maybe that the number is in Saudi Arabia somewhat larger, but of course the sky is much darker in Saudi Arabia because there are no such illuminations as you find of the cities as you find it in California, where, for instance, Mount Wilson Observatory is very much handicapped because of the lights of Los Angeles and Pasadena itself.
Professor Becker of Basel University on the telescope to be erected in Saudi Arabia. And that, unfortunately, brings us to the end of today's program. This is David Simmons
and Ron Green
saying thank you for being with us and have a pleasant week.
The overseas service of the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation is transmitting to North America in the 31, 25, and 19 meter bands.
Let's discover Switzerland. Invites you on a visit off the highways and into the byways of the lesser known regions of Switzerland. Today I'd like to take you to the western Swiss canton of Vaud. But before we set off on our little tour through the little known regions of the Pays de Vaud, as the inhabitants, the Vaudois, call their canton, let's hear some basic facts and figures about that lovely French-speaking canton of Switzerland. The French-speaking canton of Vaud, spelled V-A-U-D, lies in the southwestern part of Switzerland. It is one of the largest Swiss cantons in surface, and its population amounts roughly to some 350,000 souls. Whereas good clover pasture land and favorable conditions for the growth of cereals are to be found in the central district of Vaud, the southern border is adjacent to the rich wine-growing land on the banks of Lake Leman, or the Lake Geneva, as it is usually called. To the south are the Vaudois Alps, whilst on the northwest, there runs the chain of the Jura Mountains, in which are to be found a number of industrialized villages and small towns, such as Sainte-Croix, for example. There are many holiday and health resorts, Montreux, Vevey, on the shores of the lake, and Lesin and the Pays d'en Haut in the Alps, which are very popular with both foreign and Swiss visitors on account of their favorable climatic conditions. The beauty of the scenery. The chief locality and cantonal capital is Lausanne, famous Swiss educational center and seat of the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. Here in this western part of Switzerland, which was occupied by the Romans, the Burgundians came and settled in 443 AD. Absorbing the prevailing Gallo-Roman culture and customs. In the 12th century, this part of Switzerland became subject to the Counts of Savoy. In 1475, it was invaded by the army of the old Swiss Confederation, which was engaged at that time in a war with Duke Charles the Bold of Burgundy, an ally of the House of Savoy. After their victory at the Battle of Mora, the Swiss Confederates marched on Lausanne. Shortly afterwards, however, Vaud was returned to Savoy. In 1536, Savoy fought against Geneva, which was allied with the city and Republic of Bern, and the Bernese troops conquered Vaud, which became their subject land and was divided into 13 provinces. Finally, Savoy gave up its claims in 1617. Then, in 1723, a certain Major Davel, a zealous Vaud patriot, attempted an insurrection against Bern, but this failed and he was executed. However, in 1798, under the protection of French armed forces, Vaud succeeded in declaring itself to be a free country under the name of the Le Mans Republic and became an independent canton. The present canton of Vaud was born on April 14, 1803, on the day when the Vaud Grand Council met for the first time having been duly elected in accordance with the constitution established in Paris for the former canton of Le Mans within the framework of the Helvetic Republic imposed upon Switzerland by Napoleon Bonaparte in his act of mediation. And from that date, it became an integral part of the Swiss Confederation. On May 16, 1803, the Grand Council issued a decree regarding the national colors of Vaud and the armorial bearings of the new canton. It was decided to adopt light green and white for its colors, while as for its arms, they are as follows. A shield divided horizontally in half, the base a light green color, and the upper half being argent and bearing the words in gold, Liberté et Patrie, Liberty and Fatherland. To join me as we go west to the Jura Mountains. But I must specify, we're going to the Jura Vaudois, that is to say, to that part of the Jura Mountain chain which belongs to the canton of Vaud. I have to make that clear because some six Swiss cantons claim Jura territory, namely Geneva, Neuchâtel, Bern, Solothurn, and Basel. So it is very probable that sooner or later we'll pay another visit to the Jura Mountains. Well, from Bern, which is always our point of departure, we reached the Lake of Neuchâtel by car in about 3/4 of an hour. This lake is situated at the foot of the Jura Mountains. As a matter of fact, its northwestern shore forms fairly exactly the border of the Jura Mountain range. For the moment, however, it's not the northwestern shore that we are interested in, as that is mainly canton of Neuchâtel territory, but the southeastern shore. Driving from the lower end of Lake Neuchâtel towards the upper end, on the southeastern shore now, of course, we hit upon a rather strange, if not disconcerting, thing. Every now and then we are told by village signposts that we are now in the canton of Fribourg, then, a few miles later, that we are now in the canton of Vaud. Well, the explanation is simple. The canton of Vaud's neighbor, Fribourg, has 3 or 4 exclaves in the midst of Vaudois territory. So as 2 of these exclaves border on the Lake of Neuchâtel, the road on that side of the lake passes cantonal borders 4 times. But it seems to me that things are getting a bit involved. So let me tell you something about... Music boxes. But why should I all of a sudden tell you something about music boxes? Well, having passed those various exclaves along the shore of Lake Neuchâtel, you end up in Yverdon, a busy town on the upper end of the lake. From there it is about 10 miles up into the Jura Mountains to Sainte-Croix. And this Sainte-Croix is the hometown of the music box.
Here's Mr. Roche, owner of one of the largest music box factories, to tell us about the history of music boxes.
Musical movements were invented in Geneva by a watchmaker named of Antoine Fabre in 1796. Then, later on, the industry of musical movement came to Sainte-Croix. In the first time, it was made watches with music, then much many jewelry pieces with musical movement, and all very beautiful pieces in gold with diamonds, pearls, and so on. Snuff boxes were also made, and one of the first large customers was Napoleon. Napoleon has ordered snuff boxes, round ones, with the tune La Marseillaise, to make present to his generals or marechals. The musical movement to start were very small, then they came larger and larger, because the musical movement on this time was the first mechanical piece to reproduce music. And for instance, in Sainte-Croix came many very big composers in order to adapt on the large musical boxes their music in order to give the best play and record of music.
It was the only way of recording music at the time then?
At the time, yes, it was the first one at all. Then later on came the gramophones in 1900. Then we thought the musical movement would suffer very much from the gramophone. That has happened, but few years later, 1906, 1910, the musical movement developed to a middle size of music to be placed in toys, in gift items, and from this time it has raised and raised in the production, because there is so many fields for application of the musical movement. For instance, in our factory we manufacture more than a million musical movements. They go, half of them go in toys and the other part in gift items. We have started in the line of musical history in 1950 to make again the smaller musical movement as it was done on the birth of the musical pieces. Then out of that we make key holders with music, many charms with music, and we try to make it always smaller. We have already three small types of musical movement.
With that music box Lanzin, we leave the music boxes and their home, the little town of Sainte-Croix, and head south towards our next stop. While we drive along, winding our way through the many valleys and over many hills, I'd like to read to you a short paragraph from a travel book by Patrick Pringle. Swiss watches are made in the shadow of the Jura Mountains, through which many tourists pass, although few bother to stop. With the highest peak only about 5,500 feet, they are mere foothills compared with the soaring Alps. But they have a rugged charm that is reminiscent of parts of Derbyshire, for they consist of the same limestone. So you get splendid gorges, caves with stalactites, and disappearing rivers. You can also find lovely villages far from the beaten track. This is unspoiled Switzerland, so the less said about it, the better. Those who can best appreciate its relatively quiet beauties will find them without any help. These were the words of Patrick Pringle, who was impressed by the often barren but romantic landscape of the Jura. But we are definitely neglecting vaudois music, so let's listen to an old dance tune, a waltz, from the canton of Vaud. And with that old dance tune, we've reached one of the jewels of the Jura Vaudois, the tiny little village of Romainmôtier. Hidden away between rather steep hills lies this village, which at first sight seems to consist merely of an enormous church. As a matter of fact, the huge old church is the most outstanding feature of the village. Only some 10 or 15 houses cluster around it. By the way, in French, one always speaks of Romainmôtier and its church. Early in the 5th century, a young man from the south of France called Romain decided to consecrate his life to God and settled down, all alone of course, in a rugged and uninhabited part of the Jura. Soon afterwards, his brother Lupicin joined him, and around 430 AD, a tiny community had gathered around them. The place acquired a certain fame as a monastery, and even before its founder, Saint Romain, died, it was named Romainmôtier, the Monastery of Romain. But the whole settlement was completely destroyed around 610 by the Alemans. Thanks to the generosity of a nobleman, Felix Camlen, the monastery was rebuilt in 630 by disciples of Saint Colomban. In the middle of the 8th century, Pope Etienne II visited Romainmôtier and dedicated the church to the apostles Peter and Paul. At the same time, the Pope decided that Romainmôtier shouldn't be Romani Monasterium, Romans monastery any longer, but should be called Romanum Monasterium, a monastery directly controlled by Rome. A certain Godinus, or Godinus, was made abbot of Romainmôtier. Then, in the late 8th century, Romainmôtier fell under the rule of Rodolphe I, King of Burgundy, who left it to his sister Adelaide. Adelaide gave it away to the monks of Cluny, so Romainmôtier became the 7th monastery that entered the Order of Cluny. The church that we see in Romainmôtier today is the 4th one that was built. Its construction lasted some 30 years, from 996 to 1028 AD. With the death of Théodule de Rides in 1537, the last monk died in Romainmôtier, for the monastery closed its doors. Romainmôtier had become Protestant. From 1899 to 1914, the church was carefully restored, and in 1952, the whole village celebrated the 1,500th anniversary of the foundation of Romainmôtier. Straight across the Jura Mountains, up one hill, down another, through gorges and along rivers that cut their way deeply into the countryside, until we reach perhaps one of the most beautiful lacks in the whole of Switzerland, the Lac de Joux. The lake lies between two mountain ranges, the Mont Tendre on the Swiss side and the Mont Rizou on the French side. The lake, by the way, is situated just a few miles from the French border. The western shore of the Lac de Joux is, for the most part, inaccessible. Steep, stony cliffs fall right down into the lake. But along the eastern shore, there is quite a good road that offers a splendid view over the lake and mountains. The Joux Valley lies at an altitude of over 3,000 feet, and harsh, cold winds blow through the valley. And this wind is a notorious feature for the people who live in the little villages up there. The inhabitants have answered nature's challenge like this. They have covered the side of their houses facing the stormy wind with wrought iron from the roof right down to the ground. Sometimes they cut several holes into the wrought iron for windows, but as often as not, the southwestern side of their buildings is completely windowless. Now, as time is getting scarce, let's drive right over the Marché Rue Pass and down towards the lake. Through really lovely countryside, the road leads to the sunny slopes of Lake Geneva, perhaps the most famous Swiss wineland. But apropos Lake Geneva, here's what Patrick Pringle says in his travel book. To the confusion of foreign visitors, the people who live on the shores of the lake are in violent disagreement about its name. In the town of Geneva, they call it Lake of Geneva. But if you refer to it in that way when you are in Lausanne, the capital of the Canton of Vaud, you will probably be corrected and told its name is the Lac Léman. Hence the story of the discomfiture of the Englishman who was trying to show off his knowledge of Switzerland. I always thought, said the lady to whom he was talking, that the Lake Léman and the Lake... So they are, to agree. But in my opinion, the Lake of Geneva is by far the more synonymous.
Mrs. Lionel Mirabeau. Mr. Mirabeau always had a great admiration for the Musée Grévin, and later, when he met Mr. Crépin, who is an artist at Lakes Wax Museum in France and in Montreal.
In Canada?
Yes. Gave him the idea to realize a wax museum in Switzerland. And particularly, he chose Nyon as the ideal place because of its location on the Lake of Geneva and own long history.
Now, what are some of the figures that are shown in this wax museum here on Lake Geneva?
Well, some of the figures, of course, our Wilhelm Tell, Winkelried, Calvin, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Dunant. Mr. Mirabeau had the idea that the story of well-known, famous people, Swiss, of Switzerland, would be told and seen perhaps in a more attractive way in a wax museum.
But I can see here that there are other things here. For instance, there is an art gallery.
Yes, that is the great hobby of Mr. Mirabeau, and for the love of modern art, he has now also realized a gallery where contemporary sculptors and painters are exhibiting their work. Thank you.
today. I leave you with the accordion duo Hofstetter Jeunet, the accordionist Jurassien, but I hope you'll join us in 2 weeks' time when we'll set out again to discover Switzerland. Until then, this is Nick Lombard saying goodbye, everybody.
That music played by country musicians from the Gentle Discover Switzerland. Our English speaking listeners are invited to be with us again tomorrow when our transmission will begin at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 31.46 meters, 25.61 meters, and on 19.60 meters. And that next Sunday, as we see tomorrow, will bring you the second Sunday special. For Italian-speaking Swiss abroad, Prisma Svizzero follows next. But now, it's time to say goodbye to all of our listeners in North America. So this is Monica, wishing you all a very pleasant Sunday, and saying bye-bye for now from Switzerland.